to wrap this up. Also get before you, if you have on the notes, for Mark 3:14, because we will probably get started with that in our second session. But let's wrap up this doctrine of patience first. We were down, left off with point J. As we mentioned in another point, but I put it in here again, additionally, like all believers, the pastor is to be patient and content with what God provides and not seek to pursue his own prosperity. 1 Timothy 6:6-11, where it gets into this issue of money in the ministry, which really should not ever be an issue, period. Men that make it an issue manifest their maladjustment to God's plan. Godliness, he says, actually is a means of great gain if it's accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world. As a result, we cannot take anything out of it either. And this is actually an object lesson to us. How did you come into the world? Naked and screaming. How are you going to go out? Probably the same way. Hopefully not. But the fact is, you didn't bring anything with you when you came. And you're not taking anything with you when you leave. Like, with the exception of what doctrine you take with you in your human spirit as you manifest and grow in grace. But if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. And here's one of the most misquoted verses of all time. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. It's called a root, the love of money, because you can't see it. But yet, it will manifest itself as, say, the difference between a root and an actual overt plant, which you can see. Well, the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. Why? Because people, because of their love for money, will compromise the truth. They will do all manner of things. They will steal, lie, cheat, rob, murder, even, all for money. And so money yields a lot, well, the love of money yields a lot of potential evils in life. So this plunge men, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and have pierced themselves with many griefs. See, God desires for the believer to be happy, to be blessed, and these things come as a result of orientation to him. Maladjustment to him brings the opposite: unhappiness, dissatisfaction, lack of blessing. I want to live on the high side of this deal. The sufferings of the pastor teacher are designed to provide comfort for believers as they observe him patiently enduring the sufferings of the ministry. They should be encouraged to follow his example. 2 Corinthians 1:6. And so while I've never been perfect, never will be, no pastor ever is going to be, the fact is, over the course of the last 24 years, there's been an example set of faithfully and patiently hanging in there and doing the job with, and the number of believers has changed over the years from one time. I mean, we had as many as 40 or 50 coming, and other times we've had as few as 6. So how many ever believers God provides, that's up to him. The teaching's going to be the same. It doesn't matter if there's 6 here or 60. I'm going to teach the same things in the exact same way. 2 Corinthians 1:6, for if we, your communicators, are afflicted, it is for your comfort and deliverance, salvation. Or if we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which is effective in the patient enduring of the same sufferings which we ourselves also suffer. At a certain level, if you're going to line yourself up with the truth, you're going to suffer some of the same things I suffer, just as because you're just aligned with the truth. Not because you're in the ministry or because you have those pressures on you. But lining up with the truth may bring a certain amount of suffering into your life. It may bring hostility from those who are negative. That's just the way it's going to be. We've been briefed on that. We've been told it's coming. So don't be shocked. So people will withstand you. They will oppose you. They may even attack you. Well, this is all a part of suffering for Christ and enduring what he endured in time, as people attacked him for no good reason, simply because of his stance for the truth. Also, 2 Thessalonians 3:7-9. Uh, For you yourselves know. And this is a kind of thing you can point out to the congregation. Well, you've observed me over the years. You've watched. You've seen. Does he hang in there? Does he do his job right? Does he get frustrated? Does he throw in the towel? All of these things. Or does he keep plugging along? And these people could see how Paul functioned. And he could cite this as an example. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you. And he said, not because we don't have the right to do this. I mean, we could request money. Paul says, you know, but I have the right to be supported by you. But Paul, of course, always underplayed that or downplayed it and said, you know, the issue isn't that I have the right to do it, but we're setting an example for you to follow. And not because we didn't have the right to this, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you, so that you would follow our example. And then L, although the patience of the pastor is emphasized, there is a need for patience on the part of those receiving the teaching as well. Hebrews 13:22. And in this case, as written to the believers there in Jerusalem, I urge you, brethren, bear with this word of exhortation. Be patient with it. Because I have written to you briefly. And the author Luke, the author of Hebrews, says essentially, look, I just write this to you in this way, but be patient with it and let it have its place in your life. Well, M, the Corinthians serve as a negative example, since they were neither patient nor tolerant of the sound doctrine taught by Paul. Nevertheless, they were very patient with false teachers and the unsound teaching they espoused. And that's frustrating to a communicator, as you might imagine, that people will listen to unsound teaching, give it an earful, but will not take up with the truth. Frustrating, but it's just a part of the ministry. It's part of life. You can't force people to orient. They have to orient as they choose to. It's volition. We are strict volitionalists. It's your choice. We can present the truth, but you have to choose whether or not to accept it. 2 Corinthians 11:4, for if one comes and preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. He's being sarcastic here, by the way. Sarcasm. Oh, great, you put up with this nonsense, but you won't orient to what we tell you? And that is very frustrating, obviously. So 11:4 there, and also verses 19 through 21. For you being so wise, sarcasm again, tolerate the foolish gladly. For you tolerate it if anyone enslaves you, if anyone devours you, if anyone takes advantage of you, if anyone exalts himself, and if anyone hits you in your face. To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison. We don't do that. That's not our approach. We don't take advantage of you. And nor are we ever going to, is his model here. All right, our last point here, examples of patience. There is great value in being acquainted with those in the Bible that have been successful spiritually, since the believer is called to emulate them. This is a value of studying life stories, various histories we find in the Bible. And some people, again, tend to exalt these people as though they were somehow otherworldly and way different people than you and I are. They're people just like us. Men, women, who've lived through this world and who oriented to God and made it spiritually. Hebrews 6:12, so that you will not be sluggish, but be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. See, one of the things you've got there in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 11, it says that if you're going to be blessed by God, if you want to be blessed, what are the things that are necessary? Well, first, you have to believe that God exists. That's the first thing. I mean, if you really want a relationship with God, you actually have to believe he exists. If you don't believe God exists, well, then you're never going to have a relationship with him. That's obvious. So, see, I don't have a relationship with Casper the Friendly Ghost because he doesn't exist. But God does. So I got to believe that God exists, and that I got to believe that he becomes a rewarder. Now, this doesn't mean he is a rewarder immediately, but it says he becomes a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Well, this implies some time. that you have to continue to pursue God. You have to continue to pursue God and His plan. And ultimately, given enough time, you will come under God's blessing if you do these things right. If you don't, you're going to come under God's discipline and judgment. Those are your two choices. You only have two choices with God. It's or in or not. I mean, that's kind of it. So we're called to emulate those, and we realize that God does become a rewarder of those who do. And so it may take you 5 years, 10 years, 20. I don't know when God will open the gates and bless you fully. But it won't be immediately. I can pretty much be assured of that. It doesn't happen immediately. I see very few believers who just get with it. And that's not to say God couldn't. That's up to God. It's His call. But the fact that He becomes a rewarder indicates some change, some time elapsed for you to orient, and then God begins to pour out the blessings. And this obviously, of course, it weeds out those who aren't serious. Oh, well, I've served God for a week now. Where's mine? Well, good Lord, can you imagine if you had that approach towards a job? I've been on the job a week now, why aren't I president? It doesn't work that way, for one thing. You have to work your way up. Well, Abraham manifested patience with respect to the matter of his heir. Hebrews 6:15. God made the promise to Abraham. See, Abraham is almost 100 years old, and his wife is 90. And she's past menopause. She can't bear children. That's over. And so if they're going to have kids, it's got to be miraculous. There has to be something beyond the normal course of human events. And so God intervened with Abraham. And he said, and so Abraham, verse 15, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. But he had to wait for quite some time to get this. And then when he gets it, as we're going to see, God tests him with it. And that's also recorded in Genesis 21:5, where he gets his heir, where Isaac is born. Well, see, Joseph manifested great patience in his life as he endured evil treatment at the hands of his brothers, the wife of Potiphar, and the broken promise of the chief cupbearer. Genesis 37:28. And in Genesis, one of the things we see here in the life of Joseph is that the positive believer is often not understood by his family. This can be a real problem. Because if they're not likewise positive and don't want to adhere to the plan of God, well, then there's going to be some conflict. And there was conflict within this family. This family is no different than some other families. Conflict is a reality, but here, spiritual conflict based on Joseph's orientation to the truth and his family's lack thereof. That created these problems. Genesis 37:28, and because of the hostility that existed here, Joseph goes out one day to meet his brothers. And verse 18, actually, when they saw him from a distance, before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. This is a great family where the brothers kill each other. And they said to one another, "Here comes the dreamer." And so they wanted to kill him, throw him into the pits and kill him, and say a wild beast devoured him. Just take his garment back to his dad and tell him, "Oh, we found this, poor Joseph, he's dead. Animal got him, tiger or whatever, got him." And Reuben heard this and he rescued him out of his hands, said, "Don't take his life." So ultimately, they throw him down in this pit in verse 24, and the pit was empty without any water in it. And they sit down and have a picnic. While their brother's down there crying, screaming, begging for help. All the things you would be doing if this happened to you. So they sit down and they start to enjoy it. And they say, "Well, wait a minute. How are we going to..." Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it to kill him and cover up his blood? Let's just sell him. Make some money off the deal." Oh, this is a family for you. The true love. I mean, seriously. So then the Midianite traders passed by. They pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus Joseph was sent into Egypt. So he gets into Egypt. Well, chapter 39, it comes to pass. He ends up as a slave in the bodyguard of Pharaoh's house. This is a guy high up in the military. He is, in fact, probably in some ways second only to Pharaoh. He's his bodyguard. I mean, this is the guy he trusts the most. And Joseph ends up working in his house. And the Lord was with Joseph in verse 2, and he blesses him, and he's successful. As he will, the positive believer, lots of things can happen to you, but ultimately God can bless you through all of it if you're willing to endure and put up with his plan and be patient and see how it works out. Okay, I'm committed to doing it right, God. I don't care how it works out. I just want to do this right. Because we're only going to get one shot at this life. I mean, when you're young, it seems like it lasts forever. It does not, believe me. We're offered only, generally speaking, 70 years, 80 by means of strength. But the average lifespan's about 70 years. I remember when I was, 9, 10, 11, 12, time looked endless to me at that age. I mean, the 3-week vacation I got in summer, which I spent practically every day playing baseball, was like it never ended. And then, of course, they never told me you're going to grow up and you don't get 3 weeks, 3 months vacation every summer when you join the workforce. And so it appears, life may appear to last forever. It doesn't. It goes by quick. I mean, I've calculated it out, and if you're allowed 70 years and I'm almost 60, well, 6 sevens, that's about 14, 6. I'm about 65% through my life. Or actually more, 75% or 80%. Well, when you look at it for like that, you're thinking, oh, well, I don't have that much time left necessarily. Well, this is why we're exhorted. Say, for instance, in the book of Ecclesiastes there, remember God, remember your creator in the days of your youth, because these are when the big decisions in life are made. And these are the things that will determine the course of your existence for years to come. And ultimately, if you want to be blessed, if you want to be happy, content in God's plan, then good decisions should start very early. That's what we strive for. But obviously, all of us don't come to doctrine that way. We go through our lives and we come when we come. I was about 27 or 28 before I got hooked up with the truth. Other people come later in life. You just never know. But it doesn't matter when you get there. It's what you do after the fact. Well, here is Joseph in this household, and it came to pass, verse 7, after these events, that the master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, sleep with me. Went to have sex with him. And Joseph says, no, this is wrong. I'm not going to do this. This is an affront to God and my master. And he refused, said to his master's wife, behold, with me here my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. He has put full responsibility and trust in me, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. And there's nobody greater in the house than me. And he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? And Joseph refused. He said, no. Well, she engineered, manipulated some circumstances, and it came about. She kept doing this day after day in verse 10. And Joseph kept ignoring her. As you've got this predatory female now on the prowl, and she's ready to take a prey. And Joseph is her prey. She's the one he's picked. But Joseph is righteous. This is her problem. He's not stupid like the rest of the people out there in Egypt that don't know God. And many men would fall for this. And it came about one day she wouldn't listen. She catches him. She grabs his garment in her hand, and he went outside. And she fled. And then, so of course, she lies and says, oh, he came in to rape me. That's her story. Well, guess what? Her husband believes her. And Joseph gets the short end of the stick on this and gets thrown into prison. And then while he's in prison, he has an opportunity in chapter 40. So in chapter 40, verses 14 and 23, there are two people in prison with him, and he interprets, Joseph in this context, interprets two dreams. They both have dreams, and Joseph explains the meaning of them to him. From a doctrinal perspective. In verse 14, only keep me in mind, Joseph says, here's your deal, you're going to be restored to your office, in verse 13. Now the other guy, his dream suggested he was going to die, that Pharaoh was going to kill him, he's going to put him to death. And so Joseph says, when you get back into your office, mention me, hey, remember me, I'm down here in prison, and I've done right by you. And so he asked him for this kindness. And then verse 23, Yet the chief bearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So Joseph's mistreated on any number of levels. You say, well, in my life, I guess my family hasn't sold me so far. I guess I'm a step up there. I've done better than Joseph. Then I wasn't accused of rape when I didn't do anything. And then when I do right by people and they make promises to me, they don't follow through. Well, so we can all identify with some of this. Things that like this happen in life. Well, he hung in there under all of this. And guess what? In the end, he ends up being the vizier of Egypt. He ends up being second in charge only to Pharaoh. And in fact, runs the entire land of Egypt for at least 14 years, if not more. And Pharaoh essentially just kicks back and Joseph takes care of everything. And that has to be harmonized again with Egyptian chronology, but we'll deal with that at some other time. Job is known as a chief example of patience during the time he oriented to the attacks of Satan. James 5:11 mentions him. And we know that these attacks of Satan included attacks on his family. They killed his kids. We know that they included attacks on his details. They stole his camels, his oxen, and all of his monetary stuff. We know that ultimately it finally came down to a personal attack on him and his health, that Job suffered greatly under this plague of boils that he had. From the bottom of his foot, it says, to the top of his head, covered in boils. Painful skin eruptions make shingles look like a walk in the park. And Job endures all this for a while. Now, Job finally cracks under the pressure. We know that. Anybody that reads the book of Job should know that. By chapter 3, Job cracks. And the rest of the book is Job and his friends out of fellowship. Fun, fun, fun. And so they discuss the issues of life. They're out of fellowship because they're judging Job. They basically say, well, God wouldn't be doing this if you weren't some kind of secret sinner. So clearly, things are going bad in your life because God's against you. Well, they were wrong. They were judging him and they were wrong. And Job's out of fellowship because he blames God for all this. When in fact, Satan's the one that did it. And he blames God. He says, God's my enemy and I haven't done anything, so therefore God is not righteous. Bad position to take. But Job took it out of fellowship. And yet he's cited as a great example of patience because he did endure this for some time. We don't know exactly how long. 5:11, we count those blessed who have endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings. And that the Lord is full of compassion and merciful. And what do we see at the end of Job? If you flip to that book, at the very end of Job, we have an explanation of all that God did and a summary of his purposes in all of this. And what happened because of these tests that Job went through, and he failed the test. After a point, he failed the test. But he did ultimately, obviously he grew through this. He had a greater appreciation for God and his plan. And so in Job 42, the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends. And the Lord increased all that Job had twofold. Then all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before came to him as they ate bread with him in his house. And they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversities the Lord had brought on him. And each one of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys, 7 sons and 3 daughters. And so God, his first children died in these attacks. And so God restored them. Well, he didn't restore them, but he gave Job new children. And that doesn't mean that, obviously, you wouldn't miss your first children and that they died. You would feel bad. But obviously, if you're getting on with your life and you have more children, then that takes the sting out of it at some level. And so you see, at the end of it all, the patience of Job was rewarded. Even when he failed, it was rewarded at the end. Like the Old Testament prophets, are seen as examples of suffering on behalf of the truth and enduring it, patiently enduring it. The Old Testament prophets, in many cases, were treated horribly. They were killed. They were certainly persecuted. And James talks about that in James 5:10. And we look at what happened to these people who go through these various tests. History has it Isaiah was put in a log and sawn in half. Jeremiah was thrown down, as we know, into a muddy well where he was essentially knee-deep in mud and left down there for some time. We know that they attacked his writings and destroyed them. Take as an example, brethren, of suffering and of patience. Take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. But we consider the ones who hang in there and make it, those are the ones that we talk about. Those are the ones we consider blessed. And then Paul serves as a chief example of Christ's patience and indicates that same type of patience characterized his ministry. 1 Timothy 1:16. At the end of the day, we have here a verse that would suggest that Paul is the worst sinner that's ever lived in human history. You think, oh, there had to be people worse. Charlie Manson, Adolf Hitler, etc., etc. Nope, not really. It's not to say these men weren't evil. They were. But the fact is, Paul said, I was the foremost of sinners. Jesus came into the world, verse 15, to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost of all. Now, under inspiration, this is either true or it isn't. And in this case, it's true. Why? As he says. And yet I found, as the foremost, I found mercy, so that Jesus Christ might demonstrate his perfect patience. As an example, and the argument is, it's called an a fortiori argument. It's an argument from with all the more force, is exactly what it means. If God could save the worst sinner that ever lived, he can save you. If God could save Paul, he can save anybody. That's the argument. And he's demonstrated his patience. He didn't kill Paul when Paul was out there wrecking the church, killing believers, throwing them in prison. Men, women, children. He was patient with Paul. And at some point, obviously, confronts him there on the Damascus Road, as we know. Also, 2 Timothy 3:10 and 11, where Paul talks about this is the type of patience, the type of ministry that he also had to follow through himself. He had to patiently endure all these sufferings. He said, you followed all of this, my persecutions and sufferings, such as happened to me at Antioch, at Iconium, and at Lystra. What persecutions I endured. In other words, I was patient and hung in there and made it. And out of them the Lord rescued. Out of them all, the Lord rescued me. So, the Thessalonians are designated as a model church. And that model involved exhibiting patience in the midst of persecutions and afflictions. 1 Thessalonians 1, 6 and 7 attaches this Greek term here, tupos, from which we get our word type. Type comes from this word, T-U-P-O-S. And the type, he says, or model, in verse 6 and 7, but you became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation. Tribulation means that which produces pressure, any kind of pressure that would be on the life of the believer. With the joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became a model, an example, to all the believers in Macedonia and in Achaia. And then 2 Thessalonians 1:4, he talks about them enduring these pressures and tests and patiently handling them. And therefore, we ourselves speak proudly of you among the churches of God for your patience, your perseverance, and your faith in the midst of all your persecution. See, they don't throw in the towel. They don't assume, oh, this is all going against me. That means God's against me, so I quit. No, they said, no, this doesn't mean God's against me. This is just the nature of the beast. And then Jesus Christ, obviously, is the supreme example of patience, as he endured all that came upon him during his life and endured the shame associated with the cross. Hebrews 12:2. This is our example to whom we are looked. Another value of studying the Gospels is that we can see how Jesus handled these things. He was patient with these disciples. And these men could be exasperating. I mean, they couldn't put two and two together and come up with four half the time. And yet Jesus kept dealing with them and patient and hung in there with them. And in the end, they made it. So this is a value of patience. It gives people the opportunity to make it. Now, if they don't make it, that's on them. But if we give you the time and the patience and the grace to grow up, and you don't, well, that's your deal. That's not mine. I did the right thing. I was patient with you and gave you every opportunity. Hebrews 12:2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him. Now, how did Jesus get through all this test? He was focused on the rewards. This is one of the things he looked at. He didn't look at just the suffering and focus on how bad it is. He looked at the blessings down the road. And what's one of the blessings? The blessings is he's the firstborn among many brethren. He multiplies his life by a great factor when he suffers and dies for the sins of the world. Because he's ultimately going to be the savior for everyone who's positive for all time. See, the mechanic for salvation is the same throughout every period of human history. And that is simply faith in Messiah. Now, we happen to know that Messiah is Jesus Christ. But Adam and Eve, they didn't know any of that. All they knew was the seed of the woman. Well, they exercised faith in that. That there was going to come a seed of the woman that was going to destroy Satan ultimately. And that was Jesus ultimately. But they didn't know that. They just exercised faith in, okay, he's coming, the coming one. So, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of God. And then 1 Peter, we wrap up here with 1 Peter 2:21. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. And how did he suffer? He was patient about all of it. He committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. He just accepted it patiently. You call me names, you mistreat me, you abuse me. All right, I'll put up with it. Now, that's at the first advent. Second advent? Uh-uh. Going to be very different. Jesus is coming back and he's ticked. And when they run into him the second time, it's not going to be the same. Because he's going to come in the full righteousness of God and execute judgment where it's called for. Whereas at the first advent, he said, I didn't come to pass judgment. That's not why I'm here. There will come a time in my existence when I will pass judgment on all humanity. We will all stand before, as believers, we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And he will evaluate your phase two, your life. How did you do with doctrine? He's going to evaluate that. And that's going to be the source, or lack thereof, of your rewards. He did not revile in return, and while suffering, he uttered no threats, but he kept entrusting himself to the one who judges rightly. Okay, well, we got through that. Let's get back to our text now, just to somewhat refresh you on where we are in Mark. We are dealing with the prophecy. This is commonly called the Olivet Discourse because it took place on the Mount of Olives. As Jesus is sitting east of Jerusalem and looking across the Kidron Valley, and he can see because of his perspective, and the disciples can see, they're sitting up high on this mountain, and they can see right down into the city, and they can see the temple and the glory of it and all these things, which he's told them are going to be destroyed. Now, there's two aspects that we're dealing with here, which, of course, the disciples thought were probably just one aspect. But they were concerned with this matter of the destruction of the temple. And this comes from the statement of Jesus in the first part of Mark 13. As he's going out of the temple, verse 1, the disciples said to him, Teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. And Jesus said, Do you see these great buildings, these magnificent structures, these architectural masterpieces? Not one stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. In other words, I'm going to raise this entire thing to the ground. It's all coming down, everything. It's going to be destroyed. Well, they believe that this is a prophecy with respect to the destruction of the temple, the establishing of his kingdom, and in their minds, the coming kingdom of the Lord, which they don't know, they believe, is coming immediately. They think he's going to set this deal up. Again, they, in their minds, they're kings in waiting. They're just standing there. There's 12 of them. Judas is an unbeliever. But all of them believe that he's going to set up this kingdom and they're going to be high mucky mucks in the kingdom. They're going to be ambassadors and premiers and all these things and have these elaborate offices that are fit for them. And they'll be ruling with Christ as the way they see it. Now, that all is going to come to pass, but not like they think. This is how far out of it they are. So the destruction of the temple, what we have here, as you're looking in terms of prophecy, we are here, they are talking in 33 A.D. As a matter of fact, it's in Nisan. This is the last week of Jesus' life, and they're on Wednesday. So they're this is Nisan 12, 33 A.D. Now in 70 A.D., this prophecy about the temple being destroyed is going to take place under the Romans. But as they ask questions about the end of time as well, they don't know that they're doing that, but they do. And so Jesus looks forward in history and gives them answers about what's going to happen in the 21st century. Now, they don't obviously are not able to put all this together at this time in their thinking. But he jumps ahead now to a period that is still future from where we are, in fact, has not occurred as of yet. And so when you look at this prophecy, it has both a near fulfillment in the destruction of the temple in some ways, but there are certain things that cannot be reconciled with that event that are in this prophecy. And one of them is coming up in our verse, in verse 14, where we're ready to resume. And so what you have here is that Jesus tells them, okay, you have the age of Israel in terms of dispensation, that there are dispensational realities in God's plan, which is interrupted by the church age. Now, the age of Israel extended from the institution of the Levitical priesthood, which was circa 1445 B.C. or so, up till the time of Christ, 33 A.D. Before that was the age of the Gentiles, where the family priesthood predominated. Here, the age of Israel, in which the Levitical priesthood dominates. And then here, where the royal priesthood dominates. And then we return. There's 7 years missing out of Israel's history. This is seen in prophecies of, say, Daniel chapter 9, 24 and following. And recorded, the events of this final 7 years, are recorded for us in the book of Revelation. Well, in this 7 years, okay, at this point, the rapture occurs. At some point, the rapture occurs, the dead in Christ rise first, and we who are alive and remain are snatched off of planet Earth in one moment, in the twinkling of an eye, that fast. Millions and millions of believers just disappear off the planet. And people make fun of this, they laugh at it, they say, oh, they've been saying that for years. Okay. Well, they said the Bucks would win the Super Bowl for years too, and they finally did. Well, not that they'll ever win it again, but still, the point is, people say, well, I'm going to dismiss it because people have been saying it for years. Well, if it's true, then that means it's only that much closer, in fact. And so the church age ends with the rapture, and we're taken off the planet. At that point, there's nothing on the planet but unbelievers for just a brief moment. And they are here going through the final 7 years of human history. Well, that 7 years is divided into 2 3.5-year periods, roughly. There is a middle point here at 3.5 years. The first part of this 7 years following the rapture is relatively uneventful. And I say relatively uneventful because when you compare the second part of it, it's horrible. I mean, all hell breaks loose on planet Earth. In fact, all the demons are now confined to the planet. Satan is confined here, and he's not a happy camper. And he, as destructive and as evil as Satan is, when he gets confined to planet Earth, he goes nuts. And he really begins an all-out war that the likes of which people have just never seen. Demons will be turned loose on people. Suffering is going to be tremendously intense. And many, many people will die because of it. And then you're going to have natural catastrophes that are going to add to this. Earthquakes, famines, various problems like that. Then you're going to have distinctive judgments like the destruction of the U.S., which occurs here probably about 5 months before the middle. In 1 hour of one day, our country's going to be gone. Destroyed. One-shot nuclear strike. Boom. It's over. And Americans have kind of known this for many, many years. They just don't want to think about it. They just think, well, okay, Russia, you know, we went through the Cold War and everybody was scared, and, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and everybody thinks, oh, well, that's all resolved. We're all fine now. The Russian bear has no longer got any teeth. Oh, he's still got teeth. He may be sleeping now. The bear's in hibernation. But when the bear comes out of hibernation, he's going to turn loose a destruction like you wouldn't believe. So this all gets to be pretty dramatic. Well, during this time, right about here, at this point, Antichrist appears on the scene here in human history right after the rapture. So any speculation about who's the Antichrist? Well, he's not on the planet. You're not going to know who he is. I mean, we can deduce who he is from a study of the scripture, but he's not present yet because he's a resuscitated unbeliever who comes back, we might say, from hell. He's been in torment for how many ever years he's been in torment. And he gets a chance, a second chance, to live on planet Earth. And in fact, during that time, the Antichrist will appear, begin to consolidate his kingdom, begin to make his move, and at some point, he's going to declare himself to be God in the flesh. You say, well, nobody would believe that. Well, yeah, they will. That's the sad thing. They will believe it. And that's what we're going to be looking at here, is at this point, when he declares himself, he sets himself up in the Jewish temple. Now, here's another factor in all of this. The Jewish temple has to be in place. Is there a temple in Jerusalem now? No. The temple has not been reestablished as of yet. And that is a critical sign, in fact, in all of this, is that the temple has to be present before we can say, well, we're really, really close to the end. Now, we have other signs and other prophecies that tell us that we're living towards the end of the church age. We have all the prophecies about how evil it's going to get, how they'll reject sound doctrine, all these things. You have the prophecy about the Laodicean church era, those that are involved in the pursuit of money and the details of life, rich and wonderful and have need of nothing. And yet, we have that. We have Ezekiel chapter 37, the prophecy of the dry bones, the regathering of Israel into its own nation. That's a sign of sorts. Now, that has been called the sign of the fig tree. It is not the sign of the fig tree. We are going to straighten that out coming up in these passages. That is not the fig tree. But do we know that Israel has to be back in its nation before its spiritual recovery? Yes, Ezekiel 37 makes that plain. So we have a bunch of prophecies. There's a vague one in Hosea 6, rather, 1 and 2. That says, and talking about the Jews, that the Lord is going to strike us for 2 days, but on the third day he'll raise us up. And so we would look to a period of approximately 2,000 years for the Jews to be out of their land. Well, they went out under discipline in 70 AD. The nation began to be reestablished in 1948. But Jerusalem was not made the capital again until like 67 during the Six-Day War. And so you got passages like that. You got the 2 Peter passage about the day of a day with the Lord is 1,000 years and 1,000 years is a day. What's that all mean? It means that there's been 7,000 years of human history decreed. Well, as near as I could calculate it, I think I had it at about, I can't remember now, 58 or 59, 45 or something, somewhere in there, as the beginning date for Adam. See, there's a biblical chronology that we work off of. And that chronology is accurate. See, this is where the actual truth is held in the Bible. See, all this, oh, well, the human, we know we dated this, creation occurred exactly 4.3 billion years ago. Wrong. Did not. No way. There's no way. There's nothing that would allow for that time, amount of time in human history. God has decreed 7,000 years for human history. We are closing in, actually, and I said 59, it's 39 rather, 3945 BC. What we can safely say is that there's no evidence that man's been on the planet more than about 6,000 or 7,000 years. There's no historical evidence at all that man's been on the planet very long. So people can argue about the age of the universe all they want. The age of the universe is in some ways irrelevant to all of this. Because it doesn't matter how old the universe is. What we do know is God spoke it into existence and he's going to speak it out of existence. The universe is not eternal. This is one of the fundamental teachings we receive in school in our science class. Matter is eternal. It can neither be created nor destroyed. Wrong. God can create and destroy matter. Matter is not eternal. And so we have about 7,000 years of human history. Well, 3945 here, plus about where are we at? 2013. We're closing in 58? We're closing in on 6,000 years of human history. We know that the last 1,000 years is the millennial reign of Christ on the earth. So we have a lot of things that tell us we're close to the end. And that the history, as you and I know it, is about over. And yet, people, well, I'll take my chances. Well, good luck. You're going to need it. Because history, when it ends, it's going to take, the Bible's very plain. The vast majority of people will be taken completely by surprise by this. Because they don't buy it, they don't believe it, they never read it, they don't study it. It's not in their repertoire. So here we are, we're going to advance to a point now. So we know we're at the end, or we're getting close. And then this issue here that we're going to move forward here. Now, what happens is Jesus deals with general issues and tells the disciples that when you see all these things, don't be shocked. You're going to see persecution. You're going to get arrested. You're going to face betrayals. You're going to see famines and earthquakes in various places. You're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars. See, again, we've got our country, which is, again, you're being brainwashed. We are not at war with anybody. We haven't been at war with anybody since World War II. Only Congress can declare war. The president can't just unilaterally run around and say, we're at war. American people do not know the Constitution, and it's going to be their downfall. As we let these idiots run around and convince us we're at war. We're not at war with Afghanistan. We've invaded their country. But we never declared war on these people. And how are you going to have a war on terror? I'm still scared. It's not working. How are you going to have a war on terror? Well, this is just a way to classify enemy combatants as who? Well, you're a terrorist. Why am I a terrorist? Well, you don't agree with all our governmental policies. Well, nobody should agree with all of them. But the fact is, you have this situation. We're not at war, but I guarantee you, we've got troops massing along the Syrian border. What do you think's next? War with Syria. But we won't really be at war. See, there was no such thing as the Vietnam War. Didn't exist because we never declared war on that country. No such thing as the Korean War. It was the Korean conflict, but we didn't declare war. And so you have this nation running around talking about wars and rumors of wars. Well, we're one of the chief warmongers, frankly. I mean, our view has always been, probably was America, well, we're the good guys with the white hats and we're going to ride in and save everybody. Well, that's not who we are anymore. Hadn't been who we are for a long time. And yet people don't want to hear this because, you know, number one, it's not popular. It does not cater to the patriotism, rah-rah patriotism that people want to instill. What we're going to have to do is look past our nation to the bigger picture. As a believer, you've got to learn to do that. Or you're always going to be off balance in terms of history. And you have to look at your nation objectively. As the Jewish prophets did, my people perish from lack of knowledge. And Jeremiah, Isaiah, they prophesied the destruction of their own nation. Because God had told them this is going to come down. Well, we've got the prophecies that know our nation is going down. This idea that you're going to turn America around is not true. It is a pipe dream. You need to step away from the pipe because it is a pipe dream. This country isn't turning around. It's only going to get worse. And now they hold us hostage with budget negotiations, sequesters, whatever. I'll just keep the American public off balance. That's all you got to do. And they're good at it. They're very good at it. And so you have to look at all this. Well, okay, you got all these things happening. He says, don't be afraid by this. This is not designed to frighten you. This has to come to pass, just the way it is. And he says, essentially, he says, you're looking, because they'd ask him about some signs. Tell us, in verse 4, when will be the sign that all these things are going to be fulfilled? And Matthew fills that in and points out that they ask three questions. When will these things be? The destruction of the temple, i.e., what will be the sign of your coming? How will we know when you're coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? Now, if the sign of the end of the age doesn't precede the sign of his coming, it's not worth much. Because, obviously, once he gets here, it's too late. See, when Jesus returns in judgment with his holy angels and begins to take this planet apart, as in many ways it's already going to be torn apart before his actual arrival, but he begins to take this planet apart, but when he does all this, it's going to be too late to orient then. So if you're going to orient, the sign needs to kind of be somewhat before that. And we will deal with that as we get into this. Well, in verse 14, as we're going to see, Jesus leaps ahead in history. And this is not uncommon in prophetic literature. Prophetic literature, you can have a verse that deals with two events that are thousands of years apart. But this is where, again, key interpretive aspects have to be understood by the pastor, or he's never going to figure this stuff out. Obviously, not knowing the languages hamstrings you. You can't do it without that. You got to know the languages in which it was written. And so when we get to, and I guess we're not going to actually get to this today, so our time is up, but we will pick up here on Tuesday, and we will be looking at the appearance of Antichrist in human history, what's going to happen. And so you're going to get a big dose of here's what our future holds in the not too distant future. In terms of the prophetic scheme of things and where the word of God is headed, where the plan of God is headed, and where human history is headed. And I can tell you where human history is headed in a word, to an end. And that's where it's headed. But people don't like to think about these things. But again, God provides us information so that as believers, number one, we're not off balance by all this. We're not confused by all the rhetoric, by the hype, by this and that. We're not confused about what all they're doing and why. I have some pretty good ideas about what they're doing. And we don't know the full story, nor will we ever. But we certainly know that our government is not averse to using cameras and drones and all sorts of things to spy on the American populace. And now they want to, again, pass a deal to where if you're just declared a terrorist, that's all they got to do. You're a terrorist. You're guilty of hate crimes. Are there any other kind, by the way? I mean, really, are there love crimes that I missed somehow when I was growing up? So this deal of hate crimes, that's another part of the rhetoric to design to throw you off balance. Crimes are crimes. They're acts against individuals. Okay, well, our time is up, so we will stop there and we will take up with this on a Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.